Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
I think what Michael J. Moon is trying to say, whether he's talking about the culture as it refers to women, or whether he's talking to business professionals or corporate refugees, as he likes to call them, basically the same message applies. You need to take control of yourself and your life and get into situations that you really have a passion for, what you really want to do. And that's how you change your situation from a standpoint of being a corporate refugee versus being somebody that forms a life for yourself. And he helps people do that. So if you find that you need his services, I would contact him. He seems like he has a really different approach to getting business professionals the job that they would really love to have. So for now, have a wonderful day.
So we do make a plan, but we have a much faster and more accurate planning, but we examine the plan and update it every week or two. We never assume that it's going to work. Whereas the traditional projects, that they'll make a plan for a year, and for a year everybody's assuming that it's going to work, like Obamacare, okay? 4 years, $500 million. Everybody's assuming that's going to work, but there's no way to test it until they turn it on.
Yeah.
And when they do, nothing works.
Well, nothing, yeah.
So that's the waterfall way. The agile fix to Obamacare was to bring in a team of agile guys, and they said, okay, we're going to prioritize a backlog, and today we're going to work on somebody's going to be able to log on and get some health care insurance today. Who is that? We're going to write something that makes that happen day by day, multiple times a day. And in 6 weeks, they signed up 7 million people.
Well, isn't that like solving any goal that you had, breaking a goal down to sizable chunks so that you can get something accomplished? Because if you just try to take on the whole goal at once, likely you're not going to succeed. But if you,
exactly.
And so it's taking some of those basic management principles and applying it to project development.
Exactly.
The rest of that interview will air next week, so make sure you tune in next Monday to hear the full interview with Jeff Sutherland. Now, here is Michael J. Moon.
Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hey. Good day.
Yeah, I'm glad you came. I want to talk a little bit about your Startup Ready company. But before we get into that, can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background? Your background is pretty interesting.
Sure. For the last 25 years, I've run an innovation think tank in the Bay Area, currently located in the hills of Oakland in the San Francisco Bay Area. And as an innovation think tank, we combine a little bit of primary research, user or market research, publications, and thought leadership, where we take our findings out to the world in terms of white papers, events, conferences, and things like that. And Gistics really has tracked one particular area of the larger information technology area, which is information technology and software, both in the enterprise and in the consumer, with a deep involvement in digital media.
What are some of the projects that you've been involved with starting and getting going in the...
Sure.
Yeah.
I'd say that the three or four large or more prominent projects that we have done. One was started with Apple Computer in the early 90s, when interactive multimedia still hadn't found its name. We were engaged by their developer support group to interview and survey a whole bunch of their multimedia or new media developers to ascertain what their requirements were for support and programs. Our research led to not only giving a definitive structure, a value chain structure to it, but it led to a report and a series of white papers that formed the foundation for Apple multimedia program, as well as IBM's, Microsoft's, and Adobe's.
Okay.
Then a little bit later, we're engaged with Apple again in the mid-90s, back when they're right in the middle of their turnaround, and we worked with their pro division That's the tower computers, or the big boy computers, for doing graphic design, new media, Photoshop, and video. We were part of their Masters of Media program, and we wrote three or four white papers that were sent me all around the world. One paper was on strategies for building digital brands. That led to a book that McGraw-Hill published in 13 languages called Fire Brands, Building Brand Loyalty in the Internet Age. That went on subsequently to become the Bible at companies like Nokia.
So do you see things that you've put into that research implemented throughout all the different industries?
Yes.
And is it kind of neat when you see your work? I mean, people don't even realize it's your work, but it's your work going on.
Yeah. yeah. One of the other aspects that came out of that research was coming up with a term to describe these special multimedia databases for managing reusable digital content. We gave it the name of digital asset management. And that went subsequently went on and to produce several annual reports. I became the editor-in-chief of a journal of digital asset management, the chairperson for two conferences done around the world, and saw digital asset management move from this little humble workgroup multimedia database to these enterprise-class systems that are now at the basis that provide the foundation for most marketing departments and content marketing groups. I can't name a single firm, a Fortune 1000 firm, that doesn't have some form of digital asset management. So I kind of led that parade.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Yeah.
Well, that's something you can put your, what do you call it, little stripe on. So what is your startup ready? What is the point of that? What is it?
Right. Startup Ready is essentially executive education and social learning network. So it's a social network dedicated to executive education and skills development. The problem that we address is that the rate of technology innovation will continue to accelerate 10x in every 5 years. Practically what that means is that my iPhone today in 5 years will be 10 times faster, 10 times cheaper. And in 10 years, it'll be 100 times faster or cheaper. And in 15, 1,000. And so on that curve, on that exponential curve, a number of very interesting consequences result in our society.
Because there's so many different applications and ways we can utilize technology that's going to then change the way society operates.
That's right. So we're not just talking about semiconductors, but we're also talking about the human genome and personalized medicine. We're talking about graphene and carbon nanotubes and nanotechnology. We're talking about all kinds of things like 3D printers, not just of products and things and foods, but perhaps even biological parts. We're looking at the augmentation of human intelligence and the ability to do things that are quite literally now impossible to imagine.
Well, yeah, we could actually create improvements for our ability to think. They're working on things where we could tie our thought process to a computer that could feed back so that we could think faster.
Well, that's right. Now, another interesting thing along that line that will come in and challenge a lot of the presuppositions of your last comment there, neurocomputational imaging, which is hooking up functional magnetic resonance imaging systems to computers, and we actually watch the brain work at the level of the cognitive and conscious. And there we discovered some really interesting things. Nothing happens without neural activity. So things like spiritual experiences or psychic experiences or these, aw shuck, gee, I kind of knew you were in a car, those will register in data. So all this metaphysical hoo-hoo stuff is now going to move from kind of parascience, parapsychology now to hard data and neurocomputational imaging systems and data analytics of what's actually going on in the brain.
So we can actually analyze if somebody has the ability to read somebody else's mind or to be able to do interesting things, we can be able to translate that into data. We'll be able to have hard facts of what's going on.
Right. So just as I said, my little iPhone in 10 years is going to be 1,000 times faster. We're also talking about little sensors. So we quite literally will probably have little sensors embedded in our scalp that'll be like nanoparticles, probably no bigger than a hair follicle, that will be part of a real-time imaging of what's actually going on in your brain. One of the interesting things so far from the current state of technology is that right now we can image about 1 million or so neural connections out of the several trillion that we have. Well, that's just a limitation of transistors and semiconductors and sensor technology. So as sensor technology is faster and faster, cheaper, cheaper, faster and faster, cheaper, cheaper, all of a sudden, we'll, according to some of the studies I've seen, right around 50,000 to 10,000 neural connections in terms of discrete imaging is we'll be actually see the vocabulary, the visual or metaphorical vocabulary that the brain uses to construct our experience and our sense-making map of the world called reality. So we're going to discover that we know a lot more stuff than we know, hence tacit knowledge, that this tacit knowledge exists in a social network, reinforced by motor neurons and these other kind of ways by which we mirror the not only behavior, but moods and sensibilities and thoughts of others, and that we in fact are, we've always been psychic all along, and that the technology is going to come along and say, and here's the data to prove it. Well, I know that sounds like...
Well, everybody has moments. I wouldn't say everybody, but I sure the heck do have moments with my husband or with my kids where you're just, you read each other's minds. You finish
right.
The sentence before they do. And so you know that somehow you're connected.
Yeah.
But
there's going to be an app for that. And I'm going to say in the next 20 years, that will be the social norm. And it will be abnormal not to have those experiences on a daily basis with the people that you work with. So we are fast entering a time of miracles and disruptions and transformations.
Don't you think that scares a lot of people though too? It's the introducing that to the to the society is very scary for people.
It's only scary if you try to move too fast. Look back 120 years when they show in the Lumiere, the French cinematographer, he was showing a train, railroad thing going by, and people in their chairs jumping out because they thought the train was going to run over.
I remember seeing that.
People who thought that they would die of a heart attack should a train travel faster than 45 miles an hour. So, yes, it is scary, but it's also a matter of acclimation.
Yeah, it's a slow thing where people can start to... I don't know if people will be ready for it in 20 years, but it sure will be interesting.
So Startup Ready basically starts with that assumption that we are fast moving into an age of disruption, transformation, and miracles. And that the consequence of that is that industries will be disrupted. So far, the Fortune 1000 has shed 20 million jobs, case in point. In this last 15 years, 940 executive secretary jobs disappeared.
And that's all factual, right? I mean,
that's all a matter of economic bureau.
Yeah, and so the fact that we've lost 20, because you look at our recession and you think that the recession is based on the financial shenanigans, which really makes me mad. There's a lot of that.
But the job loss, I want to talk a little bit about
those jobs, because we're losing more small companies than we're gaining. But if we've also lost 20 million jobs because of technology and what you're talking about here, then there's a different phenomena going on, not just because we got a bunch of financial elites that are a bunch of jerks.
Well, those financial elites became elite as a function of leveraging technology. So you could say that the shenanigans that they pulled,
they did pull a bunch of shenanigans.
Which is a function of technology enablement. Had they not had all of those supercomputers and those rocket scientists, they would have never been able to do those credit default swaps and all that other kind of hoo-ha. My point, though, is this, is that as technology continues to accelerate, industries are getting disrupted by faster, more agile, scaling startups, which is where all the jobs are. So if we look at job growth, new job creation, some 87%, 87% of all job growth happened in firms less than 200 people. And then if we apply the Pareto rule to that, 80-20 rule to that, we say, okay, and 80% of the jobs in that thing happened in firms less than 40 people.
Well, but the bigger companies know this. And so what they're doing is they're taking their vast resources and they're just buying out companies.
Sure. They're buying companies and largely killing them.
Well, yeah, it depends on what they do. If they incorporate it into their company, then they kill it. If they let it be a standalone thing and just give them resources, maybe not.
Yeah, well, that's all fine. Here I am. I'm a midlife. I'm a 45, 50-year-old, 55-year-old executive. I've got a house, a mortgage, kids in college, and I'm seeing, oh, my God, I am not going to make it to retirement. This industry is undergoing such changes. Businesses are shifting left. They're shutting jobs left and right. The likelihood of me being thrown out of my keister is 100%.
Or 99.9%. Unless I really grovel.
That's 100%. If you're a mid-level manager, 100%.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right. Mid-level manager.
All right, so I'll grant you 99%. But it's a virtual certitude that you will become what I call a corporate refugee.
Especially if you're a middle-level manager.
Absolutely.
But you're going after the middle-level managers for this company. But if you're a low-level employee doing a job that can be automated, you better be thinking too.
Well, that's right. But more often than not, it lets circumstances do your thinking. Oh my God, I've just been laid off. I can't find another job. What do I do? And so Startup Ready starts with the premise that you must make a career pivot. And that starts with thinking of yourself as a business of one, and that you need to have a business model canvas by which to describe what do I bring to market, how do I charge for it, how do I market, how do I deliver it, and more importantly, how do I create revenue-producing situations that, one, draw upon, if not express, my God-given gifts and native genius talents, and in environments that I find conducive and pleasant and rewarding. So, look, the job that you really want doesn't exist until you go create it. So Startup Ready is about creating jobs that didn't exist before.
So how do you go about doing this? Okay, so somebody's a 55-year-old right. level executive. Some of the younger 40-year-olds are going to be upper-level management eventually. But say you're a middle-level manager and you're realizing that, oh, my God, I really got to do something different. And you find these people, or they find you. What happens then?
Perfect. So the first thing that happens is they generally go through some death and dying experience, you know, denial, anger, negotiation, and finally surrender. So some people will get through it really quick. Some people take years. So because everyone's different, everyone resists reality to a different degree. Okay. So the next part, so we have tools for them to kind of understand kind of the truth of their situation.
So it starts off at like a 10-step program.
you can call it that. You can call it that. But if first
taking
of all,
their hand to help them understand reality.
Right.
Okay.
Largely the people with whom we have worked have already gone through that. They're hungry for the next step.
Well, they wouldn't come to you unless they were ready, right? I mean,
right.
They classic want something different.
Classic early adopter, right. And so the next thing we do is we do a audit of their curricula vitae. And we have them go through each job they've had from the most current back to their first jobs on a big tablet of paper, sheets of paper with three columns, things I hated, things I love, things I want, the things I learn. And as they go through this, job after job after job, they discover there's a pattern to the stuff they hated.
So you have to, so it's important to figure out what you hate.
Yeah, and largely what you hate are core value violations.
Interesting, okay.
We all have core values. Largely because it's like water to the fish, we don't see it. We only see our values in breakdown. We only see our values, experience our values in sharp contrast when they're violated, which is why it's so important to go through the stuff that we hated. Now,
okay.
In the course of doing that, one of the things there's another interesting pattern that shows up in this audit of your curricula vitae, that you, on some level, are still resentful or regretful. You're still engaged in fighting a battle that has long since concluded.
The baggage.
Your baggage. So we have some tools by which to, one, tell the truth that, yeah, you're still carrying that baggage, and a way of kind of letting it go. Ultimately, it's about forgiveness.
So you need to get rid of your baggage in order to move on and get creative and do your other stuff.
You don't need to.
You don't need to?
You don't need to. But I'll tell you, it's a lot easier moving on than...
I can't carry my 15 bags with me and get my... I can carry all my baggage and luggage and get it all going?
Sure you can.
Well, but, that's good to know.
But you will find that it's a lot easier and a lot more fun and things happen a lot more quickly when you are now looking into reality through a clean window as opposed to one that has been smudged and smeared and greased with resentments and regrets from your past.
Well, you get rid of that weight, right? Your lighter weight, kind of, too, right?
Well, we can
speak
about it.
You don't look at it like that way?
Sure. There's absolutely a kinesthetic component to it, which is weight, downer, and all those other metaphors of a kinesthetic or a physical awareness. But more importantly, your imagination expands. You will see connections that were hiding in plain sight. People will all of a sudden pick up on that, and they'll start calling you out of nowhere. Hey, gee, there's this opportunity. So I'm just saying, the clearer and more buoyant your mood is as you go into a market, the more attractive and the more engaging and the faster you'll find success.
And you're happier and more directed.
Absolutely. And in fact, when we study serial entrepreneurs, they say that the most important thing to manage on a day-to-day basis is their energy and mood.
I would agree with that.
So then what are some tools by which to manage your energy and mood? So that's part of our curricula is, so for example, a structured morning meditation. Here's how you actually plan your day and making sure that you plan into your day things like rest and meditation and nutrition and exercise.
Yeah, because if you get super busy, there's one thing about eating right, but a lot of people just bypass the exercise point. As you get older, you need to eat right, you need to exercise, you need to do all these things that take care of your body.
Absolutely. And more importantly, you need to schedule those activities like appointments with customers. It has to be in your calendar until it becomes habituated.
Yeah, because it takes 21 times or something to do something before it becomes a habit?
I've heard that said, and I pretty much refute its scientific basis.
Oh, is there, everyone's different? It takes a different amount of times for someone to form a habit. Is that your point?
A key variable there is motivation. So am I motivated at the level of oxygen, or am I motivated at the level of water, food, shelter, or entertainment? You know?
Is it a basic motivation? I got to do this because I want it with my whole soul versus, I'd rather sleep.
That's right. That's exactly right. And in fact, those are what those really great entrepreneurs are, is they want something so badly that they want it with all their soul. Now, so then the question is, what do they want? Do they want fame and riches? Almost without exception, no. That's a consequence of doing something else. So what is it that they love? What is it to which they devote themselves? Well, ultimately, they devote themselves to some sort of service contribution. Some make a difference in a business model that allowed me to capture value in relation to the value that I added. And that I had a lot of fun bringing a lot of people along with me in this great journey. So
do you think most of them are visionary types that they want to bring everybody along with them, or do you think they're more they like the whole experience?
There's a whole range, and the point is that one generalization does not fit all.
Okay, that's fair. That's good.
Yeah, the whole point of Startup Ready is to say, okay, you need to make this transition into the open frontier of entrepreneurship and startups. Most of the skills that you developed in the corporate world as a corporate professional are out of place, if not toxic, in a startup, especially in a scaling startup with 15 to 30 people.
You're saying the bogged down bureaucratic habits.
Well, it's just how you manage your inbox. What goes in your inbox? See, the thing about working for a company is all your marketing is done for you. It's called your inbox. In a startup, you've got an empty inbox.
Yeah, you got to do it yourself. You got to get out there and do it. And they don't realize.
No. It's not a matter of doing it. Yeah, yes, there's the doing of it. But there's something that precedes the doing of it.
What is that?
What? Why am I doing this? How am I doing this? And what am I delivering? So that's what I'm saying. In a startup, it's just one big wall of fog.
Whereas in a company, it's already been defined for you.
That's right. Your marketing's been done for you.
You will take somebody and you'll say, okay, you need to rethink what you are and what you're doing. Think of yourself as a one-person business.
It's not a matter of you need to think. You're saying, what do you want? Because if you
let's be fair. You have to rethink how you go about getting what you want.
But let's start with what it is that you want.
Okay. Well, you've got to figure that out first.
So let's go through let's do an audit of your curriculum vitae to find out the desires that brought you here. And as you do a thorough scrubbing of each of the wins and losses, as you release many of the regrets and resentments of your career, there emerges, wouldn't it be cool if I? And what you're really talking about is, I am now not only have a sense of a future that I want to create, but I have a sense of living in that future already. So the other part of being startup ready is that you now have a dialogue with your future self. Now, yes, it's an act of imagination. Yes, it's just imagination. Yes, of course it is. But it's your imagination, and you get to determine whether your imagination syncs up with what's going on in the world or not.
Now, how long does that process take?
It's different for everyone. But the point is that we do most of our learning in small groups, where we focus on really very prosaic things, like before I pick up a call and do for a business development, what should I do before I pick up the call? What act of imagination? What should I, basketball players pre-visualize the shot on the hoop, or baseball batters pre-visualize hitting the ball? What does the entrepreneur pre-visualize?
You have to visualize success at what it is that you're doing.
Well, I would suggest that one, when I pick up and call somebody, the person on the end connects with me as a human being, one, connects with my vision, two, and connects with my vision as far as how their life will be better as a function of our relationship. Because that's ultimately what people want. People want to know, hey, Sarah, how's my life going to be better? How are you going to enrich my life or my business as a function of our relationship? And to the extent that you can communicate that in really one out-breath statements, business development is actually like reading poetry. It's fun.
It is fun.
Yeah.
I just don't like always doing the hard work that comes after. So you have to make sure it's it's something that you really want to do.
Well, that's right. And not only do you really want to do it, but you've got competence, exactly. Skills and tools to do that, or you're willing to learn. And two, you're really just, you're in it. You've made this promise. Are you going to keep it?
Well, I've heard one of the things that I love this metaphor, that you're in a boat with a whole bunch of holes, and the only thing that you possibly can, you can't jump out. You have no life jacket, and you have to row. And you have to bucket out the water as fast as you can. But your only two tools are rowing and getting the water out. But you have to do it. And
well, I would say that as a precondition for rowing and bucketing the water out, a precondition for that is you have to give up cursing your circumstance.
Absolutely, you have to look at it positively. You have to love it.
Or at least just be neutral about it.
I think you have to love it.
Well, it's great when you can love it, but sometimes these things, these suckers are just not very lovable.
There's always a portion that's not lovable, and you have to do it. Okay, so now you got this person, you have them mentally ready and geared up. What do you do now?
Well, it depends on what they want to do next. So let me give you an example of somebody that I'm working with later this afternoon on. He makes $500,000 a year. He's the number one salesman in the world in his particular industry. Now, some years he makes $750,000 a year. Someday he makes $350,000 a year. Now, that sounds like a lot of money. And, relative to most of us here, it probably is. For him, it's just like, hey, I create adjacent revenue streams. I've done it my entire career. But the problem is his industry is collapsing through technology. So he can't just go to another company in this industry because, he's been there, done that, and they'll never pay him the kind of money he's making now. So he has to kind of jump out of his particular industry. The problem is most of his exciting opportunities are in startups. So how many startups are willing to pay him 350. Well,
that not an accurate statement? You can get a startup that has a lot of financing and they'll pay you a whole boatload?
Especially if it's a matter of, we've cracked the code, now it's just a matter of pedal to the metal. How fast can we grow this?
So you're saying that they could pay you that immediately if you're in the right startup, or you need to get your act together? Okay.
So in his case, he got lucky. Not lucky. He was lucky because he was prepared. So that's what we do in Startup Ready. We have a whole framework and a set of tools to prepare you to see the opportunities hiding in plain sight. And more importantly, opportunities that speak to your God-given gifts and your native genius talents in working environments that you find just joyous and happy and fulfilling and rewarding.
So,
and these opportunities hide in plain sight because we are looking through a dirty window, smudged and greased with the resentments and regrets of our past, not having really understood what are my core values as a function of violations, what are my God-given gifts, how have I expressed them again and again and again and again through my entire career, and how might I package those gifts in a way that reflects what's wanted and needed now.
So what do people pay you for this? What kind of, how much does this cost to go through this entire program? And do they, can they do it from their home, or do they have to fly out to you?
We are still building the program. So I'm still kind of doing, I'm still prototyping the core program. So I work with, say, for example, a handful, what I call scaling startups, people that are 20 to 40 people, and they're really beginning to scale their company. The problem that they have is they can't find needed talent for very specific jobs. So for them, I've created a framework called an executive internship. Now, an executive internship works a lot like an internship, except I'm dealing with 45, 50, 60-year-old professionals who will come into a startup and charge half, a quarter, a fifth of what their normal rate would be for a 30, 60, 90-day period in which they develop and execute a project. Usually it's revenue-related, channel expansion, like business development or partnerships. And based on the success of the project, they create a full-time job for themselves, largely leveraged by performance basis.
Oh, that makes sense. Basically, they're creating business for this company, and then their business creation for this company pays their salary.
Perfect. So another company I was working with, we did went in and did some analysis in terms of how they were growing, and we uncovered the fact that instead of having project managers running these projects, they really need to have product managers who would take it through the entire life cycle, including negotiating with, you know, the engineering team about what are the parameters and success criteria, and renegotiating conditions of satisfaction with the customer as, you know, insights emerge. So in that case, we created a whole new role, defined a whole new job, and then went, found people for it.
So you create a win-win situation. You create a win for the startup, you create a win for the executive, and everybody's happy.
That's right.
Because they're expanding their business. And if they, if this person doesn't work out, it then costs them that much money. That's and right. If the person works out, everybody's super happy because now they got this whole another line of business, plus they get paid what they want, and everybody's happy.
Perfect. So now what you've described is a market where you got buyers and sellers who don't know how to normally talk to each other. What we do is we facilitate the introduction between buyers and sellers, the sellers being the executive seeking a position, and the buyer being the scaling startup who needs very specific skills but doesn't have a lot of money to pay for it. There's a third element in that market structure, and that's the coach or facilitator or mentor.
Is that you?
We do that. The Startup Ready Network is largely a social or a trust network of coaches and mentors to facilitate these buyer-seller transactions.
And how do they work with you? How do you get paid?
We get paid as a function of licensing our material to corporations, public speaking and publications, like posters and card decks and stuff like that. We get paid in terms of by individuals in terms of tuitions to our workshops or programs. So, and that's a long-winded discussion to We're still experimenting with our business model. We think, we have the hypothesis that it's going to be a multimedia publishing company. But until we've got enough traction in that particular, against that particular business model, we're still experimenting.
But even though you're experimenting, you've had a couple dozen or dozens of people go through your process.
So that's right.
You're not a startup in the sense of not having any people do this yet. You've been doing this for a while, and now you're trying to figure out, okay, what is the best way to now get it out there to even more people?
Right. In the framework of, called the Lean Startup, there's this distinction called a minimum viable product. And so our MVP has largely been consulting engagements or coaching engagements with these scaling startups. And that pays the bills, right? And so companies come to us and say, hey, we really need to scale our operation. At this point, we now need to put in systems and protocols to really facilitate us continuing our growth. The problem is that we don't know which systems really to put in place, and we're missing critical resources to help build us. How can you help? So for example, I'll give you a very concrete example. I've interviewed close to 50 serial entrepreneurs. So these are people that have 2, 3, 4, 5 startups. And one of the most interesting insights that came out of these interviews is, what's the most important meeting of your week? And 48 out of the 50 would say, oh, that's easy. It's the weekly sales pipeline review.
Yes, they live and die by that money coming in.
Well, who are we calling? How far have they progressed along our kind of sales funnel? What can we collectively do to move this thing forward? Okay. So then I ask these serial entrepreneurs and I say, when you were just a 2-3 person firm, how did you do a pipeline review? And at that point, they begin to squirm and they begin to like shuffle. And they go, well, you know, I really didn't do it until I had somebody to manage. And I said, great. So, would you be interested if a Startup Ready offered you a coach or a peer in a non-competitive industry by which to do mutual pipeline reviews? You say, oh yeah, totally. We do that. So that's an example of somebody needing to conduct a pipeline review.
Because they don't do it when there's only one or two people.
That's right. So what does a pipeline look like? What are the stages? Who goes in there? What are the questions that you ask in a pipeline review? So these are very basic questions that oftentimes a first-time entrepreneur will waste months or years figuring out.
So you have this idea that there's, well, it's not your idea, but there's 10 to 15 million people that are going to be needing to rethink what they're doing.
That's right. Not just rethink, but actually execute a career pivot.
And
much like you did. You know, you worked at US West, and all of a sudden now you've got a radio show.
I worked at US West a while ago, but I built and ran a company for 10 years, and now I'm doing this. But yes.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, how the heck did you do that? Well, whatever comes out of your mouth will be unique to you and will largely be nonsense to most people. Because, oh, that's just, you know, Sarah. Right?
Sarah being an idiot.
Well, no, I didn't say that, but you know,
it's a joke. You know,
yeah, but the point is that, so yes, some 15, 20 million people need to make this long journey into a large, potentially scary, open frontier of entrepreneurship and startups. Now, how are they going to do that?
It's a different mindset. See, I know I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I just know this is my world. You know, I can't go anywhere else. And if I'm in a bureaucratic company or a big, I feel like, did you see that movie, The Rocker? And he's in the cube and he has to go, or he's taking this interview. He wants to be a rocker, right? And he's sitting in this, and he needs to get a job because he's all messed up and he's sitting there. I'm ready to work in a cubicle until I die. And
yeah.
That's kind of how I feel about those kind of jobs. But, you know, I tell students I teach, it's you. People do things because they need to. Sometimes they need to make a living. And sometimes people like doing that because they like to be able to go there, get it done, go home, and do something else. So people have different needs and different wants. So I don't want to say that's bad. It's just my own view. I know I'm an entrepreneur, but that really does take a different mindset.
Yeah. Let's kind of speak with a little more compassion and empathy.
I know, because that sounded really, I care more than that.
Well, but the point is that the rate of change in the basic structure of our society will continue to accelerate, and that if you just kind of want to just move through life at a kind of like just work a day, get paid a day kind of thing, you're going to find yourself increasingly in circumstances that are more and more unpleasant.
Exactly. So the more you take control over what it is that you want and do, you're going to be happier. Isn't that the point? You'll have less negative circumstances that you find yourself in.
Well, that's right. And the circumstances that you do find yourself in will reflect your doing and your intention as opposed to what happened to me. So it has to be with, you know, am I a cause or am I an effect?
So if people want to get hold of you and they're really interested in doing this with you, what do they do? How do they get hold of you?
Well, go to startupready.net. So startupready.net and sign up for a newsletter.
Okay. And then they can get hold of you that way and figure out how to move forward.
Sure. Yeah. And then I've got my email address there and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a couple questions about how long have you been in the Valley, the San Francisco area?
Well, my parents, the family, moved to San Jose in 1965, I think. And I went to school in South San Jose. I went to university at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and I've been in the Valley since.
So you're a lifer out there. So how is what is the culture like out there? So people can understand. Because I got to tell you, there's a big Newsweek article, and I wanted to ask you about this. It just came out this week.
Sure.
I don't know if you're familiar with it. No. But it's about sexism in the Valley. And really a problem out there as far as this is what Newsweek is saying, that women have a really hard time out there. It's almost like a frat boy culture, and you don't come across like that at all. But there's with venture capitalists and with the startups and things, it's almost like a frat boy culture, and that it's really difficult environment for women. And do you see that? And how can that change? Because obviously we just want, as a country, Bill Gates did a presentation in Saudi Arabia, and I thought this was great. He had, the women were on like one third side, and they were all covered up and separated for the men. And the men were on two thirds of the audience was the men. And they said, we really want to be in the top 10 of the high tech world. And what do we need to do? And blah, blah, blah. And he looked out at the audience. He said, for one, you're never going to get there. He goes, because you only use 50% of your resources.
Yeah.
And so what is the deal? I mean, that really hurts our country when we're only using 50% of the resources. I mean, there's dummies. There's idiots who are male, and there are idiots who are females, and there's geniuses that are females and geniuses that are males. And if you look through a lens that only a certain type of person can do something, you're really short-ending what we're capable of a country for doing.
Right.
What do you see as the culture there?
Well, yeah. So I was going to respond to you, three parts to what I want in my response to you. First of all, it has to do with generalizations. The basic law of tautology here is that generalizations are generally true. And stereotypes are generalizations. So it's going to be generally true. Now we're just arguing about the granularity of cases. Okay? So kind of outside looking in, yeah, I think that's probably a true and factual characterization. But once you're in the Silicon Valley environment, there's a completely different ethos. And it really has to do more with that. I am accountable for not only myself, but I'm accountable for where I put myself. And if I put myself in an environment that is not kind to who I am, does not speak to who I am, shame on me.
But how do you?
That's my responsibility. So I'm just saying inside the Valley.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not saying outside. I'm just saying, so part of the ethos is I'm accountable for me. I make my choices. And I am accountable for not only my choices, but the environment in which I put myself. So if I'm in a sucky kind of environment, then that's on me. So it's up to me to change that. That's the second point. The third point is that while Silicon Valley is a physical place, it's also a collection of tribes. So the further south you go to Sunnyvale, Mountain View, that's really hardware, grounded by semiconductor and computer companies, Intel, Apple, Hewlett Packard, et cetera. The Seagate, Maxtor, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And so so one of the things about hardware is hardware is hard. It's uncompromising. And there's a certain grit it takes to do hardware.
Okay.
And hardware is not a solo sport, but it's a team sport. And team sports are kind of rugged, especially in those hardware teams. So it tends to be impervious to somebody who will not. So it's kind of like walking onto the football. It's like walking onto the football and wanting to walk in off the street and play for the New England Patriots or the Seattle's. Their level of play is such that, God, you're just going to get ground up and spit out, right?
Okay, sure.
All right, so I'm not defending it. I'm simply saying that the reality of that particular industry and business is harsh and unforgiving. And if I was a woman, I would probably not want to go there. It's not fun. It's ugly. It's not particularly accommodative of, it doesn't really take advantage of the things that I'm good at. Now, you go north 30 miles into San Francisco and Marin County and Oakland, Berkeley area, and it's a completely different world.
And they're more open there?
Yeah. So just put this in the context. I'm calling you. So we're having this session in Oakland, California. So first of all, the Bay Area is one of the most liberal progressive areas in all of the United States. Berkeley and Oakland is probably one of the most progressive areas in the most progressive area in all the United States. So what I consider conservative here, most people would be calling flaming liberal elsewhere. Right?
So now would you say that this was an unfair characterization of the Valley then, coming from Newsweek? Or would it have been more?
That's why I started off with generalizations are only generally true, and we're just going to quibble about the degree of granularity of facts and cases.
That's fair.
So at a 50,000 foot level, yes, it's true, especially if you're outside looking in. But that's why I said once you're here, it's categorically bullshit. It's, hey, I'm going to put myself in places where I'm honored. I'm going to put myself where I'm respected. I'm going to put myself where I get a fair wage.
Well, and I always say, if they're going to be stupid and ignore half the population.
No, it's not a matter of stupid. It's just a matter of individual choices.
I'm saying if there's certain startups and certain organizations that are being stupid because they won't acknowledge. Well, like how about venture capital companies that won't?
And this venture capital is a completely different. Let's just park it to the side.
Okay, so, let's park that and talk the other stuff then first.
Well,
and then
so
let's come
but,
back
but
to
I'm it. Saying if you're doing a web startup and you're doing where user interface design and the communication and the whole ethos or the feel of what it feels like moving through doing this, that's much more, fits much more of this sentiment and moods and sensibilities and skills of women, either with liberal arts degrees or even engineering or technical degrees. So that's why you see in dot-com kind of startups, a lot more women in fairly senior roles. Now, is it a programming environment? Yeah, it's a hacker environment. Is there a little bit of kind of geeky hacker, animal house ethos to, yes, of course. Because largely these companies were started by hackers in college dorm rooms, or in their 20s when they were, young and reckless.
Sure.
So. Is it possible for, is it likely, probable, women to have a really good career in the northern part of Silicon Valley, specifically things that have a large social component to it, or a large sustainability, social cut? Hey, that's largely a woman agenda. That's a female agenda.
Okay, well then let's get into the VC aspect. Why do they not fund female entrepreneurs when they have really good ideas?
So first of all, we have to talk about VCs. They look at the world through spreadsheets. And largely for them, past causes the present. So if I don't have any track record, I'm just saying in terms of kind of a distribution.
Sure.
VCs are some of the most regressive of personalities.
Well, 25, 30 years ago, no one had a track record in that industry. And now you have, and back then, they wouldn't have invested
I'm just saying.
People wouldn't, Steve Jobs had a hard time at the beginning.
Yeah, I was there. The discipline required to run a firm inherently makes you risk averse. People tend to invest in things they understand and like.
So the group that really needs to be educated is the VC community of, hey, you need to be looking at, because they're staff.
And so that's why in San Francisco, we have some very pioneering and women who are creating, first of all, their own network of female angel investors, out of which will percolate a whole crop of female-led VCs that will then percolate up to a whole crop of the female-led private equity firms.
Which is great, but we are...
And that's happening in San Francisco. Well,
and that's awesome and excellent. But we are a community that's shared with men. Women and men are a community together, and there should be integration of the sexes should occur on a regular basis.
No. So this is that top-down, you know, bust them around and hopefully they'll
No,
be
no,
nice.
No, I'm not saying that.
No, it is. But it's the same blunt instrument of state power. So all I'm saying is that there are environments in which your God-given gifts are recognized, honored, and celebrated. So now what we have is we have women that are now angel investing, principally in other women-led businesses, and developing the basic discipline to run a fund, to run money, to invest it well. And we're beginning to see more and more female-led VC firms, smaller firms, but still female-led. And it'll just be another 5 or 10 years until everyone will look back and go, wow, where did all these female VCs come from? Boy, where did all these board members come from? Well, we grow them organically.
So you just say they just got to do it on their own, get it going on their own, work within their own networks, and then eventually they'll have enough power where it'll start to integrate on its own.
And that's the ethos of Silicon Valley. It's not you're on your own, but it's up to you. You're accountable for the choices. You're accountable for the interpretations. You're accountable for where you put yourself. And if you want to put yourself in a pity pot position of poor me, okay, then live with it. If you want to put yourself, in a situation of, hey, I am the master of my world. I make the choices. I create my world. I bring people into it that not only get me, but honor me and really co-create well with me. Great.
I would agree with that. Put yourself in the best environment you can. Go get it done. I would like to see the attitude and the culture change so that if they have daughters and they have, hello.
And there's a whole big push in the school systems here. Daughters of engineers are getting inducted right into the whole, my career is that of an engineer. I'm going to Stanford. I'm going to major in computer science or symbolic logic. You know, like Marissa Mayer.
But that's,
no kidding.
That's good as long as that's what they want to do.
Well, exactly.
It has to get back to what you want to do. But I just want it to be we live in a community which is more accepting of. My point is that, I've been in all those hard environments too, but there's a difference of an accepting hard environment and a non-accepting hard environment. And I'd like to see that culture change a little bit. But hey, it's really been great to have you on, and I really appreciate this. And I will put your contact information on the radio page, and we will go from there.
Great. And I'd love to do a follow-up interview on some of the more specific cases of people who have become startup ready.
Yeah, that's great.
Cool.
Okay, well, you have a great day.
All right. Bye now.
I think what Michael J. Moon is trying to say, whether he's talking about the culture as it refers to women or whether he's talking to business professionals or corporate refugees, as he likes to call them, basically the same message applies. You need to take control of yourself and your life and get into situations that you really have a passion for, what you really want to do. And that's how you change your situation from a standpoint of being a corporate refugee versus being somebody that forms a life for yourself. And he helps people do that. So if you find that you need his services, I would contact him. He seems like he has a really different approach to getting business professionals the job that they would really love to have. So for now, have a wonderful day.